All right, everybody. This is Bio 241, August 27th, and we're talking chemistry chapter. Okay, yeah, I don't have a microphone. I'm going to get a microphone real soon in here, hopefully. And, we don't have a projector. I think I can fix that. And we're still talking chemistry, but hopefully we can finish that up pretty quick. So let's go back a couple lectures. If I say covalent bond, what are you going to say? Strongest. I like strongest. That's one nice thing to say. Sharing electrons, right? Remember, it's always the valence electrons that are involved in chemistry. And ionic bonds. Transfer. Perfect word. Okay. And then what's a weaker kind of bond? Hydrogen bond. It's very, very easy to break those, right? Oh, I still have projector. That should be coming on pretty soon. And which is better? Like that? Or like that? Like that? Okay. So then we started talking about different kinds of biological molecules. We talked about carbohydrates, we talked about lipids, and we're in the middle of talking about proteins. And you got to know their basic building blocks, like the basic building block of triglyceride is one glycerol and three fatty acids. Perfect. How would you make a triglyceride from those building blocks? A dehydration synthesis reaction. And what's the magic molecule that comes out? Water, right? That's what we're dissolved in, but it participates in many chemical reactions in our body. That's kind of interesting. Okay, what's the basic building block of a protein? Amino acid. There are 20 different kinds, major kinds of amino acids that can be used to make up a protein. How many letters are there in the English alphabet? 26. How many different words can you make in the English alphabet? Almost, what? Unlimited. Just by changing the order of the letters that make up a word. The same thing for a protein. You can change the structure of a protein by changing what we call, what, the primary structure of that protein by changing the order of amino acids. And what happens to the function when we change the structure of that protein? Yeah, the function changes as a result of that. It may or may not, usually does change. All right, so the fundamental structure of a protein is the primary structure, and the primary structure then determines the secondary structure. And can you give me an example of what secondary structure is? Alpha helix or beta pleated sheet? Would be two really good examples. And then the secondary structure and the primary structure determine what? The tertiary, and that's what we have on the screen right here. It's just the folding of that very long filamentous molecule into maybe these alpha helices, beta pleated sheets, and other kinds of random coils. And there are bonds that help stabilize that particular structure. Most of the bonds that are used are hydrogen bonds. And what kind of bond is a hydrogen bond? In terms of strength, it's weak, right? So it's very easy to rearrange a protein molecule, its three-dimensional shape, which is what we call the tertiary structure, by changing the pH of a solution, or changing the salt concentration of a solution, or changing the temperature of a solution. All right, we can change the shape of these molecules, and that usually results in denaturation, right? Remember, denaturation is irreversible. And one way to think of denaturation is at home. How do you denature proteins at home? What do? You cook them, right? So you use temperature. But, you know, we preserve foods by denaturing them in other ways, by putting them in salt water, all right, and also by putting them in acid. For instance, what's your favorite food that's cooked, quite literally cooked, by putting it in an acid? Like ceviche, yeah, that's how you denature fish, for instance. You basically cook it, you preserve those proteins by using lemon oil, right? Or lemon juice, sorry, not oil. So there's different ways to prepare food. It doesn't have to be just temperature. All right, so let's look at how this molecule can be stabilized. So here we got figure 2.27. Here is a long protein molecule made up of amino acids. And remember, amino acid can have different functional groups in that R position. So for instance, in this area right here, there might be, what kind of group is that? What's CO2H? We're going to have to go over that, I see. That's a carboxyl group. That's an acidic group. That hydrogen comes off and it leaves a nice negative charge. And if in a little bit different region of the protein, if there is an, what kind of functional group is this one right here? That's an amino group, right? That will accept a proton and then it can form an ionic bond between these two segments. It can help form a hairpin structure in the protein. All right, now what can you tell me about this ionic bond? Is it strong or weak? It's pretty weak, right? That can be broken by maybe changing the salt concentration, the pH, temperature. It can break, and when it breaks, guess what? The shape of the protein changes, and then maybe the function of the protein changes as well. All right, so remember, ionic bonds are pretty weak. What's even weaker? Look at this hydrogen bond, right? Between a carboxyl group, and this kind of looks like a tyrosine to me, right? That's just it's a cyclic ring compound. So that forms what? Another really weak kind of association. It stabilizes the molecule as long as, what do we do to this molecule? How do we keep this molecule to preserve this bond right here? We regulate the environment of our pH, right? The body's pH, for instance. If the pH changes in our body, it could disrupt these bonds. Proteins can change shape, and then what happens to the function of our body? It changes as a result of that. Okay. Now, here is a strong bond, right? Because it's a covalent bond. If we have a couple of cysteine residues, a couple of cysteine amino acids, which has an SH functional group, what do we call an SH functional group? That's a sulfhydryl group, right? So, we're going to have to look at some of these chemical compounds again. I'm not so sure you guys are studying enough. All right, so make sure you know those functional groups by name. All right, these sulfhydryl groups from different parts of this protein chain can actually form a nice covalent bond, and that is a relatively strong bond. It's difficult to break. Okay. And then the weakest bond, and I mentioned this before, the van der Waals forces, and they're just associations between nonpolar groups that you can find along the protein strand, like these two ring structures. This methyl group and a methyl group, these are nonpolar groups, so they like to associate with each other because they don't really want to have anything to do with water. But these are even the weakest kinds of associations or bonds to have that stabilize the molecule. So just by changing the temperature of the molecule, you can break these bonds, or the salt concentration, or the pH, very easy to break these bonds, which then changes the function of this particular protein. All right, what we see on this slide right here is that some proteins, when they're active in our body, are not made up of just one protein chain, right, but maybe a number of protein chains. So here's a pretty good example of hemoglobin, and there are actually four proteins that have to come together to fit just right, to form hemoglobin. And what's the great thing about hemoglobin? What does it do for us? It carries oxygen in our blood. So it has a special space on the inside where it can carry a heme group that has an iron atom in there, and that's what associates with oxygen. So for every hemoglobin molecule, it can carry four oxygen molecules to our body. And a single hemoglobin chain has the right shape so that it just matches up perfectly to form what we call the quaternary structure of a protein. So if it requires more than one protein strand to come together to produce a functional protein, that's what we call the quaternary structure. So what determines the quaternary structure of a protein? What does it have to have? It's got to have the right shape, and what do we call the overall shape of a protein? That's actually the tertiary structure, right? So the building block of quaternary structure we see here is the tertiary structure, and the tertiary structure is determined by the secondary structure of a protein, and the secondary structure is determined by the order of amino acids that are used to make up that protein, which is what we call the primary structure. So it's really good to have a understanding of building blocks, right? So what's a building block of a cell? Oh, we didn't get there yet because we're still talking chemistry. But maybe some of you guys know. What's a building block of a cell? If you're going to build a cell, what do you need? At least a human cell, you need organelles. All right, so it's really good to have an idea of what building blocks. Well, what's a building block of a protein, for example? Yeah, amino acid. Okay. Proteins can be modified by conjugating them with other kinds of biological molecules, like glycoproteins. We take a protein and add a sugar to it, all right, and that becomes a glycoprotein. Glyco means a sugar kind of molecule. Anybody know a good example of a glycoprotein in your body? Maybe from anatomy we talk about it. Like mucus, right? Mucin is a glycoprotein. It's part sugar, part protein. And what is mucus like? It's very, very slippery, right? But it's also a very tough kind of molecule, protects the lining of your digestive tract. Lipoproteins, what do they contain? Lipids and a protein, okay? And others like hemoglobin can contain various kinds of metal ions or pigments, okay? All right, nucleic acids. This is our last group of biological molecules. They're organic compounds as well. And the basic structure of a nucleic acid, right, has a 5-carbon sugar right here. And it can be one of two kinds. It can be a ribose or a deoxyribose. That's a 5-carbon sugar. And it has a phosphate group added to it in this position right here, and then over in this position over here, there is a nitrogenous base, which is kind of a big complicated molecule. We don't draw it out, but this is the basic building block of DNA and RNA, which is what we call a nucleic acid. So if I ask you, what's the building block of a nucleic acid, you're going to say a nucleotide, and we can put nucleotides together to form this chain right here, and without going over it, you can tell me exactly what kind of chemical reaction is used to take a bunch of nucleotides and make a nucleic acid out of it. What would you think? You just have to take a wild guess. The same way that we make a triglyceride, the same way we make a polysaccharide, the same way we make a protein from building blocks, which is what kind of reaction? A dehydration synthesis reaction. So your body doesn't have to discover anything new, it's just a typical kind of chemical reaction where there's an H and an OH come together and it pulls the water out between these two nucleotides and a nice covalent bond is formed. Okay. And you think you can break a nucleic acid down. And what kind of chemical reaction would be used to break a nucleic acid down? A hydrolysis reaction, right? Exactly right. So and we have these enzymes running around in our body all over the place because this molecule right here is very important because it contains information, and if information that doesn't belong to your body gets into your body, right, it can change how your body functions. So what you think should happen to non-native nucleic acids that somehow get into your body? They should be destroyed and broken down, and there are hydrolases that break down DNA all the time, then that just protects your body from infection. Okay. There are in DNA four different kinds of these nitrogenous bases, and they're guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. And you know, I usually don't talk about them in those long words. I just usually say G for guanine and T for thymine. And you don't have to know which one is purine, which one is a pyrimidine. Okay. But what I do want you to know is some base pairing rules. By the shape of the nitrogenous base, see one, here's one right over here, right? If there's a guanine, it can only associate itself with a cytosine. And thymine can only associate itself with adenine because of the number of hydrogen bonds that can form between these bases. All right, but also the shape of the molecules have to be right in order for these hydrogen bonds to form. All right, so why are we interested in these hydrogen bonds? Because DNA is unlike a protein in the sense that it's not just a single strand. DNA is always going to be a double-stranded molecule. So here I see one strand, and what do I see on the other side over here? Another strand. And they are what we call complementary to each other because of the base pairing rules. So what are base pairing rules? GC and AT. And it doesn't matter which way you say it. You could say AT or CG. It really doesn't matter, because those are the bases that fit together to actually give DNA its proper shape, because DNA is always double-stranded. Okay. And when it forms a double strand, it just automatically then forms this double helix, okay, due to this law of complementary base pair ruling. All right, so if you're going to think of a DNA molecule, which is made up of two complementary nucleic acid strands, you should think of the molecule in like an everyday object as being like a stepladder, right? So the steps of a stepladder are made out of what part of the nucleotides that are used to make a DNA molecule? The steps are made out of the hydrogen bonds. But the hydrogen bonds are there because of the nitrogenous bases. So the bases make the steps of a DNA molecule. And what parts of a nucleotide make the handrails of a stepladder? It is the phosphate group and this ribose. Okay? So the handrails are phosphate, deoxyribose. That's the polymer. And then sticking to the inside of the molecule are the nitrogenous bases. And the order of these nitrogenous bases then determines the order of amino acids that are used to make a protein. And so the order of these nitrogenous bases then is like a dictionary for spelling a word. And there's information in words. So there's information in the order of these bases right here. Okay. So let's contrast DNA a little bit with RNA. The basic building block is still a nucleotide. So the building block for DNA and RNA is a nucleic acid. And the sugar that's used in DNA and RNA is a little bit different. So here is the chemical formula for deoxyribose. So it's ribose, but it's missing an oxygen in this one position right here. The sugar that's used to make an RNA molecule is exactly the same, except what? There is an oxygen right here. So this is deoxyribose. This is just a regular old ribose. Ribose is a 5-carbon sugar. All right, so that's one difference between DNA and RNA. And do you think that's a big difference or a little difference if you look at this whole molecule, just the difference of this little oxygen? You know, it makes a big difference in your body, but overall my impression is that it's a pretty small difference that changes the shape enough, though, that it makes a big difference in your body. Okay, but it's just a small change in the structure. All right, the other difference between RNA and DNA is that in DNA, remember, what are the base pair rules for DNA? It is GC and AT. So we have thymines in DNA. We don't have thymine in RNA. And what happens, uracil is substituted in for thymine. But notice the change between thymine and uracil is what? Very small once again. So the building blocks that make up DNA and RNA are almost identical, but significant changes enough so that your body knows the difference between them. Okay. Another difference between DNA and RNA is that RNA is single-stranded. It doesn't form that alpha helix. There might be some small regions within the molecule that can bend and form alpha helices, right? But typically, I think in your mind, you should realize that DNA is always double-stranded and RNA is single-stranded. And maybe you should figure out where these different molecules exist inside the cell. Where would you find DNA? In the nucleus. And would you find DNA out in the cytoplasm someplace? Okay, and you know what? When we get to the cell, maybe we'll talk about this. And we don't. We find DNA in the nucleus, and if it's in the nucleus, it's protected. If it's in the cytoplasm, it can become damaged, And the DNA is the blueprint on how to make your body and how to control the activity of the cell. If that information gets destroyed, then that cell dies or becomes cancerous. And if enough cell die in you, what happens to you? Well, then you die too, right? So that information has to be protected. DNA is protected, but RNA is made from DNA. You can make hundreds of copies of RNA from a single DNA molecule. So if you lose one copy of RNA, it's no big deal, because you can always go back to the nucleus and make another copy of it. So RNA can be found in the cytoplasm. Even if it gets destroyed, that's okay. Another copy can be made. All right, we got a couple different kinds of RNA. Oh, that's it. A couple different kinds of RNA. And RNA is used to make a protein. And it's pretty much an exact copy of the information that we find in DNA. And so what are the building blocks of a protein again? Amino acids. So your cell needs amino acids to make a protein. And one kind of RNA wanders around inside the cell hunting for amino acids to bring to the workbench where that protein is going to be made. And so I think of that kind of RNA as being like a taxi. It's taxiing around amino acids within the cell, bringing them to the workbench to make a protein. And we call that kind of RNA a transfer RNA. And you could call it a taxi RNA if you wanted to. Just don't let anybody else know I told you that. Okay? Call it a transfer RNA. So where is the transfer RNA going to bring amino acids to be put into a protein? It's going to take amino acids to a ribosome. And a ribosome is an organelle inside the cell, which is the workbench for protein synthesis. Right? And it is made of RNA as well. And that kind of RNA is called ribosomal RNA. And you guys got to take a biology class one of these days to know something about a ribosome and how it's put together. There are a couple different strands of ribosomal RNA that go to make up a ribosome and how it interacts with the transfer RNA. It's all really cool stuff to learn about. Okay, but in here you should know that our RNA is the basic building block of what? The workbench that makes a protein. Okay, and where do we find most of the ribosomes in our cells? They're out in the cytoplasm. They're out in the cytoplasm. Okay, because that's where that part of protein synthesis takes place. But you know what? Your cell still needs a dictionary to know how to properly put amino acids together to make a protein. Right, because that determines the primary structure of that protein. And the definition of a protein is contained in the third kind of RNA that is like the dictionary on how to make a protein, and that's called the messenger RNA. That comes out of the nucleus, and so the messenger RNA has to work with the ribosomal RNA and the transfer RNA to make a protein that is spelled properly, right, to have the proper function in your body. All right, so those are the four kinds of biological molecules in your body. You've got what? Carbohydrates. What's the basic building block of a carbohydrate? Of a carbohydrate is a monosaccharide. Monosaccharide. How do you put monosaccharides together? Dehydration synthesis reaction to get a disaccharide or a polysaccharide. Can anybody give me the name of an important monosaccharide in your body? Yeah, even before you took this class, probably almost everybody would know glucose is an important sugar in your body, and indeed it is a monosaccharide. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? What does the name say? It's pretty easy. Yeah, it's glycerol, and triglyceride means what? Three fatty acids, and your body puts them together using a dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay. What's the building block for protein? Amino acid. How does your body put amino acids together? Dehydration synthesis reaction. I don't mean to be so boring. But the same thing for nucleic acids as well. What's the basic building block of a nucleic acid? Nucleotides. Right? And there's two major kinds of molecules that are nucleic acids, and they are DNA and RNA, and your body uses dehydration synthesis reactions to manufacture either RNA and DNA. And in my impression, the difference between RNA and DNA is pretty minuscule, right? It's just the difference of this one oxygen and the substitution of uracil for thymine when you go from DNA to RNA. Okay. All right, so that's it for chemistry. Now, I do want you to get a little facility with being able to recognize some of these molecules, because some of you probably have noticed that they are, right, they are part of your study guide for exams. So I might put some structures of chemicals on your test, and you'll have to tell me if it's, what, a monosaccharide, or if it's a nucleotide, or what's your favorite molecule so far in here? It's got to be, steroids. You know, that's a pretty good guess, steroids, right? But maybe I was, glucose is pretty important for you. Probably my favorite molecule might be the phospholipid. Why would that be a good molecule? Why might that be my favorite molecule? Because it makes all the membranes in your body, and it's got that special nature. It's got a hydrophilic nature and a hydrophobic nature, and that gives it some really magical properties. All right, so, and remember, when you change the structure of something, what are you changing? It's function. So that's why I kind of want you to know some structure of things. So here is a little quiz that we can work over. I put it in a video format that you can get off my website as well. So if you want to practice this by yourself a number of times, that's fine. So when I show you a picture of something, I want you to tell me what it is. So this is, right, this is a ribose here, and here is a nitrogenous base and a phosphate group, and if we put all these things together, what do we get? We get a nucleotide, right? So this is a building block of a nucleic acid, but look at this region right here. Is this a deoxyribonucleotide or a ribonucleotide? It's a ribo because it's not deoxy, because it's why? It's got the oxygen right there. So when you see this thing, you should say, oh, that's just a ribonucleotide. And what is it used to make? A nucleic acid, but what kind of nucleic acid? RNA, yeah, RNA, which means what? Ribonucleic acid, right? Because this is a ribonucleotide. All right, what's another kind of molecule? Oh, here I see a nice hydrocarbon backbone, but what I really want you to see is this functional group. You're going to see sulfur, but it's really what? A sulfhydryl group. So say sulfhydryl group, because that could be on the test. How about another one? What about this group right here? Amino group. Yeah, go ahead, say it out loud. That's fine. Okay. And this is a carboxyl group. Yeah, carboxyl. So if you're not seeing these groups yet, you're going to have to practice a little bit at home. Just look at your book or watch the video if you want to. All right, here is a phosphate functional group. And this, okay, you could probably tell me the specific name of this, but I just want you to tell me what the general name of this molecule is. Okay, it's a monosaccharide, and monosaccharides can form, bend back on itself and form this cyclic structure. So here is a monosaccharide. What is this a building block of? Polysaccharides, right? Or disaccharides, for instance. Okay. All right, what do we got here? Long hydrocarbon chain with a carboxyl functional group on it. This is a, well, this is a fat right here, right? It's insoluble in water, but this is the acid part of the molecule. This is a fatty acid, right? Fatty acid. And what do we have going on here? We have a glycerol and three fatty acids making this triglyceride. So what are we going to say? What kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Going in that direction. What do we got here? This is another monosaccharide, okay? But it forms a five-sided ring structure, okay? You don't have to tell me the particular name. Ah, here is something pretty amazing. This is a micelle, right? And so what's the building block of a micelle? It is these phospholipids. You should know something about the nature of these phospholipids. This region here is what region? The hydrophobic region. This is the hydrophilic region, and it just automatically forms when we put these molecules in water. Oops, wrong way. Okay, what is this? Steroids or cholesterol? You don't have to tell me which one is which, but what kind of molecule is this? Is this a protein, a sugar, or a nucleic acid? It's a general class. It's a lipid. It's a lipid, so it likes to dissolve in what? Oil, not water. Okay. And these down here are steroids, and this is cholesterol. So these steroids are just modified forms of cholesterol. All right, another one. Long hydrocarbon chain with a carboxyl group. Fatty acid. But this one is unsaturated fatty acid. It has, the shape has changed, and guess what? It has different functions in your body, okay, as a result of that. What's this right here? This is just a general formula for, this functional group is an amino group. This is a carboxyl group, so this is an amino acid. So this is a general form of how all our proteins are made. And this R just means that this functional group can be switched out to give this amino acid different properties, right, by changing its structure. All right, what do we got right here? Phospholipid, right? So here's a glycerol, three carbons. We got two fatty acids, but here is the phosphate group. So this is the hydrophilic part of the molecule. Here's the hydrophobic part right here. And what is used, what is made from that molecule? Cell membranes, or any kind of membrane. Yeah, membranes of mitochondria, nuclear envelope, endoplasmic reticulum, all of these. These are prostaglandins. They're modified fatty acids. Here's that nice carboxyl group that has that little hairpin bend in it right there. These are important signaling molecules in your body, right? So, but they're based on fatty acids. And when you see this, what are we thinking about? Okay. This is an alpha helix. And what is alpha helix? It's secondary structure of a protein. So what's the building block of secondary structure? Primary structure, which is just the order, the correct order of amino acids. And what this is a building block of what? The overall globular nature of a protein, which is what we call the tertiary structure of a protein. Okay, so if you say this, you could say alpha helix, for instance, or building block of tertiary structure, right, depending on how the question is asked. Whoa, what do we got right here? Phosphate. All right, a five-carbon sugar, which is some kind of ribose. Is this a deoxyribose or, yeah, because it's missing the oxygen. Nice nitrogenous base right here. So this is what? A deoxyribonucleotide. This is used to make what? RNA or DNA? DNA, right? So this is a building block of DNA. Functional group. Hydroxyl group. Okay. And this one right here, what's this molecule? How many carbons do you see? You got three with these three OH groups right here. This is a glycerol molecule. What could you tell me about glycerol? It's a building block for a triglyceride. Yeah, it's a building block for a triglyceride. What's this one again? Yeah, we see these two fatty acids on a glycerol and this phosphatidyl group right here. And you'd recognize this phosphate group. This is a phospholipid. And what's this group here? That's a carbonyl group. All right, carbonyl group. And maybe this is where we started. Okay, what is this? That's a ribonucleotide. Ribonucleotide. So let's go through this one more time. But a little bit faster. Yeah. Yeah, there is. And I'll pass it around just a little bit. Thank you. Thank you for reminding me. Okay. Okay. So are you ready to look at this one right here? Let's see what it is. I can't remember. What's that? That's a sulfhydryl group. It's a functional group. What is that? Amino group. Carboxyl group. Phosphate group. Is that a little too fast? Okay, I'll go a little bit slower. Until you say it. What is that? Monosaccharide. Right? Then you can build polysaccharides out of these things. All right? So I'll hold it until you say it. That's a fatty acid, but it's completely saturated. So a saturated fatty acid. Dehydration synthesis reaction. Another monosaccharide. That's a micelle made up of phospholipids. Steroids or cholesterol. Yeah, it's an unsaturated fatty acid. Unsaturated fatty acid. What was that? Amino acid. Okay, amino acid. So the nice thing is you only have to be able to recognize these. I won't ask you to draw them out. Okay, but I tell you what, if you really want to know them, go ahead and draw some of these out. And then it'll be easier to see on a test. So amino acid, right? So once you get the functional groups down, then it'll be easy to see this particular thing. All right, what is this? Phospholipid. Okay, and we got prostaglandins. What general class of biological molecules do prostaglandins belong to? Okay, what do you got? You got carbohydrates, you got lipids, proteins, or nucleic acids. These are lipids. Yeah, it's just a modified fatty acid. Right? It's a modified fatty acid. And we've got alpha helix, or secondary structure of a protein. You could probably answer some questions about that. And we've got deoxyribonucleotide. What's it used to make? DNA. Hydroxyl group. Oh, I see some people getting a little bored. Okay, I'll go just a little bit faster. One more time through there. Oh, glycerol. We didn't get through it yet. Okay, I'll keep it slow. What's that? Phospholipid. Carbonyl group. Ribonucleotide. Ribonucleotide, because of the oxygen right here. What's that used to make? RNA. Yep, RNA. I know these are mind twisters. That's okay. Sulfhydryl group. Yeah, we'll do it a little bit faster. Amino group. Carboxyl group. Phosphate group. Monosaccharide. Saturated fatty acid. Dehydration synthesis reaction. That's another monosaccharide. Micelle. Cholesterol and some steroids. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. I don't know what the next one is, but let's just look at it really fast. Phospholipid. Prostaglandins. Alpha helix, which is what kind of structure? Secondary structure. That was fast. Missing the oxygen. Deoxyribonucleotide for making DNA. Okay, we're almost done. Hydroxyl group. Glycerol. Phospholipid. Carbonyl group. Ribonucleotide. Okay. To make RNA. Sulfhydryl group. Amino group. Carboxyl group. Phosphate group. Monosaccharide. All right, so maybe some of you had noticed that looked like an impossible task just a couple minutes ago. All right, some of this stuff is making sense, maybe a little bit. All right, so what did we just demonstrate? What's a good study technique? You know what? And it pretty much always works. And that is what? Repetition is so important. So we're going to do this a couple more times, so you're not going to hopefully not miss any of these things on the test. But if over the weekend, if you want to start looking at some of these things, look what I have right here for you. A chemistry flash quiz. Probably you can download it to your computer, or I just clicked on it. So, Yeah, those flash quizzes. Well, because, yeah, it's really repetition, and it just kind of tweaks your mind to recognize some of these things. I don't know what happened to it. I don't know where it is. Is it here? No. Is it here? No. Okay. I was playing it when you guys were walking into class. Right. Actually, you know, it's this video right here. Okay, so if you want to load it to your computer, just say save target as. Save it someplace. Should we put it in Dr. Ogoshi's file? Yeah, let's put it in here just for fun. Okay. All right, so we put it in Dr. Ogoshi's file. But don't make a Ogoshi on your computer. Okay. And so how are we going to find that? Okay, hold on, you guys. Here's Dr. Ogoshi's file. And where is it? Ah, here it is. Oh, that's integument. This is where I saved it, though. Oh, I clicked into. I didn't click the. Oh, okay. Well, too bad. Let's put something else there too. Oh, I clicked this. No, Chem Flash Quiz. All right. So this just goes over all those different structures. What's really nice about this, since it's a nice video file, you can just what have random access. So if you want to go back, if you want to pause it, ooh, what's that? Alpha helix. And so it should probably say. All right. So hopefully you have speakers or a headset on your computer at home. All right. All right. And guess what? It's mostly all correct. Okay. All right. So go ahead and practice these at home a couple of times. So even if you don't have speakers on your computer, just get a headset. And sometimes you get the video but not the sound. Sometimes you get the sound and not the video. That means you have to update your media player. Maybe some of you are using Windows Media Player from 1998, which is like version 4. We're on version 11 right now. So update your media players or get one that has never caused me problems. It's this plugin. DIVX. All right, can you see the X right there? DIVX is a nice plugin. It works even with HD videos. All right, so download this one and use some videos. I'll have other videos for you to watch too. Okay. How is that? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay. Okay. All right. Yeah, that's on this one right here. That's on this one right here. Just right on the, you don't even have to go into Bio 241. It's just right here. Okay. Well, what does that mean? That means that we should actually, be moving on to the next chapter. And so what's the next chapter? Is it three? You know, we skip around sometimes.
Oh, really?
Okay, 1, 2, 3, and 6. All right, so let's move on to chapter 3. Cell structure and genetic control. All right, so we're going to look at the plasma membrane. Okay, hush down, you guys. Raise your hand if you've got a question. Okay, but you should be able to mouse around and find that stuff. We're going to look at plasma membrane, some organelles, maybe a little bit about gene expression, DNA replication, and the cell cycle. So most of these things you're kind of familiar with already, I think. So make sure that you can recognize these organelles by their shape inside the cell, all right, but also you should know what their function is. But that's just kind of a recapitulation of anatomy. You had to know that in anatomy already. So one thing is, though, that I want to tell you about is that what is the building block of life?
A cell,
right? So in order for something to be alive, it's got to actually be built out of cells. All right, so in order to understand something about life, make sure that you know that the structural and functional unit of life is the cell. It's structural and functional unit of life is the cell. So what the heck makes a cell? It's got to have three things. It's got to have a plasma membrane. So here's a plasma membrane that separates the outside world, which is not alive, with the inside world, which is alive. And it's got to have cytosol, which is the fluid part of the living system inside the cell, plus organelles. All right? And so sometimes people get cytoplasm and cytosol mixed up, but let's just say that cytoplasm is everything that's inside the cell membrane. It is the fluid part, which is cytosol plus organelles. Okay, so these three parts, including, right, the nucleus right here. So here's the nucleus that contains DNA. So this guy right here, this is a mitochondria, right? And we can see that it has two membranes associated with it. There's an outer membrane and an inner membrane. We're going to look at a detail of this mitochondria. What's the job of the mitochondria? It produces energy, the energy currency of the cell, in the form of ATP, adenosine triphosphate. And guess what? Adenosine triphosphate is a nucleotide. Okay, as well. Mitochondria need oxygen and glucose and maybe some fatty acids in particular to make ATP molecules for us. And so without oxygen, mitochondria cannot make ATP. What happens to this cell when it runs out of ATP? It dies, right? So this mitochondria is very, very important. How long, for instance, if this was a neuron in your brain, okay, how important is that ATP to have in your brain? Very important. So, for instance, if blood gets cut off to your brain, how long can you maintain consciousness? Okay, about 3 seconds, right? And then after what period of time does your brain actually die? When it runs out of so much ATP, life processes can never get started again. That's what we mean by death. You should say about 3 minutes. There's a range, right? So that's how important ATP is. 3 seconds, you lose consciousness, and after 3 minutes, you can't ever get your brain back, which is a really short period of time. So I should actually make this a prerequisite for my class. What should everybody know that's taking one of my classes, I think? Yeah, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. How do you help deliver oxygen to somebody's brain when their heart isn't beating or they're not breathing, right? Chest compressions to get their heart, and then mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to get some oxygen in their lungs to preserve somebody's brain until we can get their heart back functioning again, right? That saves lots of lives. All right, what's another good way to think about how much ATP your body needs? Not just your brain, but your whole body. All right, an average textbook person is about 70 kilograms. That's what's published in all the textbooks. We probably can't find anybody in here that's exactly 70 kilograms, but on average, that might be pretty good. So in terms of weight, how much ATP do you need to stay alive every day? You know what? You need 40 kilograms. More than half your body weight to stay alive. So that's how important that molecule is. Now, you don't have to have a suitcase with you right at the beginning of the day with 40 kilograms and eat ATP all day long, because there's an organelle that makes ATP. As soon as you use one up, it regenerates it for you. And guess what organelle that is? That's the mitochondria. As long as it has energy molecules like glucose and oxygen, it can rebuild that ATP so that your brain and the rest of your body can still keep functioning. All right, so that's very important. Other organelles that we see right here kind of curving around the nucleus and it forms sheets. This is the rough endoplasmic reticulum because it looks rough. It has another organelle associated with it, and that is our ribosome. So these ribosomes right here allow proteins to be made. That's the workbench. What's the building block of a ribosome? Okay, it is the rRNA, the ribosomal RNA. Okay, that's what you should know in this class. So the rough endoplasmic reticulum is responsible for one kind of protein synthesis inside the cell. We see other ribosomes floating around inside the cytoplasm. We call those free ribosomes. They make proteins as well, but the fate of these proteins is different than the fate of a protein made by rough endoplasmic reticulum. Proteins made by free ribosomes stay in the cytosol. Proteins that are made by the rough ER have a destiny of either going outside of the cell or staying within vesicles inside the cell. They're always going to be membrane-bound or shipped outside of the cell via a process we call secretion. So there's two different pathways or two different fates of protein depending on exactly where they're made. Okay, another kind of endoplasmic reticulum we see right here is devoid of ribosomes. So the structure has been changed. So if the structure changes, what does that mean? The function has changed. So since there are no ribosomes over here, can it make a protein? No, but they're still important for synthesis, a different kind of biological molecule, and in particular, lipids. So smoothie R makes lipids for our body. Let's see. Here is a Golgi apparatus, a Golgi complex, or a Golgi body. So it goes by all kinds of different names, and guess what? You just got to become familiar. If something has different names, you just have to know all the names that it's referred to as, right? So Golgi body is the same as Golgi apparatus, same as Golgi body, right? Just like, you know what? I have different names at different times. So you just got to be familiar and know when to use them at what time, right, as proper. Okay, so what's the job of this Golgi body right here? It accepts, yeah, you guys are pretty good at some of this stuff. It accepts vesicles from the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And what's contained in a vesicle from the rough endoplasmic reticulum? It's got to have proteins in there because that's what the rough ER makes, are proteins. And that vesicle fuses with the Golgi apparatus, and one of the main functions of Golgi apparatus is to modify those proteins, maybe conjugate it with another molecule, like a sugar molecule, right? And then it becomes, what, a glycoprotein, for instance, like mucus. And then that molecule is repackaged in another vesicle, and it can stay in the cytoplasm, or it can move to the cell membrane, like we see right here, fuses to the cell membrane, and it exocytoses that material to the extracellular material. So that would be an example of a secretory pathway. So the Golgi apparatus is an important little factory within that secretory pathway. So if you're going to just say one or two words for Golgi body's function, you would say modifying and packaging for secretion. All right, you know what? There's another real important function of the smoothie R that I didn't mention, which we're going to be really familiar with, and that is it makes lipids, but in some cells it's also very important because it stores calcium ions. And what do you know about calcium? Why is it important? It makes strong bones, okay? That's probably the least of its important functions. So we're going to learn some other really important functions of calcium ions, and the smoothie R is a reservoir for calcium for these other important functions, that other important roles that calcium plays in our body. But of course, nobody wants to have weak or brittle bones either, right? So that's an important function, but that's probably not as important as some others. All right, so the other organelle that we're interested in, think of the plasma membrane as an organelle. All right, so here is the plasma membrane. Its basic building block is this little guy right here, right? And you're familiar with this. You kind of know what it looks like all by itself. That is a phospholipid. So when we look at the basic structure of the plasma membrane or any kind of membrane, look how many layers it has. It's got two main layers, right? So we sometimes call it the phospholipid bilayer. And the hydrophilic head groups are pointing into the extracellular fluid or into the cytosol, which is an aqueous environment, meaning that is watery, right? And that's fine because the head group right here is hydrophilic. It likes to be associated with water. But on the inside of the membrane, the internal structure of the membrane, we see those fatty acid tails. Right, this is the hydrophobic region. And so a membrane is really happy to form this phospholipid bilayer just because of the nature of that phospholipid group. Okay. But that also means that this is a nice barrier because water cannot move across the plasma membrane. It doesn't want to be associated with these fatty acids whatsoever. So it acts as a nice barrier. It separates the outside world with the inside world. And have you ever seen some water with some oil floating on it? Okay. And if you jiggle the water a little bit, what happens to the oil? Does it fracture and break? Does it bend up into little plates, or what does it do? If the water jiggles around, what happens to the oily film on the water? Yeah, it jiggles right with the water, right? It's very fluid as well. So we say one way to think of a plasma membrane is the phospholipid bilayer, but a better way to think of it is the basic nature is very fluid, but what else do you see? You see just phospholipids that make up a membrane. You see many other kinds of molecules that are added to it, which means that the membrane really is a mosaic of many kinds of molecules. So a more sophisticated way of thinking about a plasma membrane is by using the fluid mosaic model in your mind. Fluid because the phospholipid bilayer is very fluid, but it's also a mosaic because of some carbohydrates that can be added to it, some proteins that can be added to it. So that means that when we change the structure of the plasma membrane, guess what happens to the function of the membrane? It changes as well. So what are some things that we can add to a membrane? Cholesterol molecules decrease the fluidity of the membrane, makes it a little bit more rigid, all right? It gives it a little bit more structure so that when you stand up, all of your cell membranes just don't dribble out on the floor, right? So that helps add some rigidity to the membrane. There can be proteins, like I see right here. Here's a protein that goes all the way across the membrane. We call this an integral protein. So again, it stabilizes the membrane, but these proteins can have holes going through them, in which case it would be a channel for transport. So molecules that couldn't get across this lipid barrier right here actually have access to the cell. And sometimes those channels open and close, right? So they can be gated channels, for instance. Other kinds of proteins might have these sugar molecules on them, and they can become antigens. And notice that these sugar molecules can have different little branches on them, like this. So the branching pattern acts like a fingerprint to your body. So your immune system knows that these cells belong to you because they have the correct branching pattern. And if the branching pattern is different, then your immune system knows that that cell doesn't belong to you. And what should happen to it then? It should be destroyed. It should be killed because it doesn't belong to you, right? That would be an important part of your immune response. So these are little recognizer signposts, addresses that tell your body that these cells belong to you and should not be killed. Now, there are conditions where your body gets confused, and we call that autoimmune disease. That's really sad when that happens. We don't know how to treat autoimmune diseases very well yet, and that's when somebody's immune system misrecognizes a tissue or a cell as being from outside your body, and it gets destroyed. And those diseases would be, for instance, multiple sclerosis, where your own body's immune system destroys the cells that make a special covering on your, you guys know this, myelin, the myelin sheath on neurons, right? Rheumatoid arthritis, when your body misrecognizes cartilage in various parts of your body as being foreign, and that cartilage is destroyed and causes severe pain and joint deformity as a result. And we're learning more and more immune diseases all the time. Autoimmune diseases, and probably we even think, or most people recognize, that diabetes type 1 is an autoimmune disease, where somebody's cells that are responsible for making insulin are destroyed. And that can happen really early in age, maybe age 1 or 2, right? That's really sad when that happens. So that's really important to know antigens on cell membranes right here. These other proteins can also be enzymes, which will catalyze reactions in the body, will change the chemistry of the cell. They can be receptors. They can look out for signaling molecules from other parts of the body. And I gave you a name in chemistry of an important signaling molecule. What can be some important signaling molecules? You know, and there was a lipid, namely prostaglandin, but don't forget that sex steroids like estrogen and progesterone and testosterone are signaling molecules. Right, we'll have to bind to receptors. So we can have receptors in the membrane, or we can even have receptors inside the cell. Okay, so we talked about surface markers. All right, so let's talk about how things can get across the plasma membrane. Right, there are generally two different ways. One is a passive process where things move by diffusion, or it can be an active process. And so what we see right here is an active process. We have a cell that is changing its shape. And it can change its shape because within the cell there is a cytoskeleton made up of microtubules and microfilaments. And these microfilaments can be pushed and pulled, and it can change the shape of the cell. So if it's a cell that can change its shape, we say that it moves by diapedesis. It's a shapeshifter. It can push out some of the cytoplasm right here. This is what we call a false foot or a pseudopod. And the pseudopod can flow around some kind of particle, right? And then it can be completely surrounded, and then it's engulfed by the cell. So that's what we would call phagocytosis. That's an active transport. So now this particle is inside the cell. Another kind of bulk transport is when a pseudopod forms around maybe just fluid and not a particle. And we call that pinocytosis. That would be cell drinking. But in every case, pinocytosis and phagocytosis is a way of bringing material inside the cell. So if material is brought inside the cell, we call that endocytosis. All right, now what can happen to something once it's inside the cell? All right, since it's in a vesicle, and now it's in a vesicle inside the cell, it can fuse with some other vesicles. For instance, this lysosome right here. Lysosome comes from the Golgi apparatus, and there are digestive enzymes inside the lysosome. So and if it fuses with a vesicle that has a bacteria in it, guess what happens to that bacteria? It gets destroyed. It gets digested. It gets broken down. And then the building blocks of that bacteria can be used as building blocks for the function and structure of this particular cell right here. So a lysosome you should think of as an intracellular digestive system. It's used for digesting things. Right? There can be other kinds of vesicles. I don't see any on this particular slide because they all have the same kind of color, but there can be another kind of vesicle that has an enzyme, not for digestion, but for detoxifying compounds that build up in the everyday normal activity of the cell, which are toxic to the cell. That particular compound would be called a peroxidase. So peroxidase detoxifies harmful compounds that are produced by the cell. And so if it contains peroxidase, we would call it a peroxisome. Right? So a lysosome contains lysozyme. A peroxisome would contain peroxidase. There can be an opposite. Yeah, let's pass this around. There can be an opposite process to endocytosis, which is bringing material into the cell, right? And on that very first slide, we saw an example of maybe this is a secretory vesicle from the Golgi apparatus. So now the contents that are inside this vesicle end up outside the cell. So what do we call that? That's not endocytosis. If stuff is leaving the cell, that is exocytosis. All right, and do you think that is active or a passive process? That's moving these vesicles around, hopping a ride on a microtubule that's pushing it and pulling it around. That's an active process. That's an active process. So any kind of vesicle transport is active, meaning that it requires what kind of molecule in your body? ATP, in order for that vesicle to move around. All right, there were some organelles that I didn't see on that slide of a cell that's in your book, okay? And nonetheless, they're important. Cilia is a projection coming off of a cell. It has microtubules in it, so it can beat. It can move around, all right? So cilia is important for motility. Cilia can be found on certain epithelial kinds of cells, like columnar cells that are ciliated. They line the trachea, and they're sweeping all the time. So, for instance, when we breathe in dust particles into our airway, it gets trapped on the surface of our trachea, and then it gets swept. Which way do you think it gets swept?
Up.
Yeah, it gets swept, and then it's out of your body, because you just then, when it's in your mouth, you just swallow it down, getting rid of it, right? Unless what? Unless you're a baseball player, then what do? Then you spit it out. We have a couple of baseball players around, so I'm picking on them now. Okay. There are other surface specializations called flagella. These are about 10 times as long as a cilium, but nonetheless, they contain microtubules as well. And there's one kind of human cell that has a flagellum, and that's only a sperm. And again, that's important for motility, so this sperm can move around in its environment. The other kind of projection coming out of a cell is called a microvilli. These are very small. They're hard to see with a light microscope. They're maybe a quarter or a third the size of a cilium, and they're not as big, and they don't have the same kind of microtubule structure, so they're a lot more transparent. These are there because they help the cell surface fold. So what these do is increase the surface area of a cell, and that's important for absorption of material. So where do you think you might find cells in epithelium that has microvilli on them? In the intestines, yeah, for absorption. Okay. So here's kind of what they look like. Here's what a cilia looks like, and the internal structure is made up of these microtubules. Okay. Okay, some organelles. What didn't we talk about? Oh, the cytoskeleton. We talked about already a little bit. It is made up of microtubules and microfilaments. It gives the cell its shape. And certain cells have certain shapes, like epithelial cells. What are the three shapes that an epithelium can be made out of? It could be cuboidal. Okay, it could be columnar. Okay, or it could be flat, right, or squamous cells. And that's determined by these microtubules. Microtubules are controlled by centrioles, which I don't see on this slide, but you probably know what centrioles look like. You can go all the way back to the very first slide to take a look at that picture of a cell. So the job of a centriole is to coordinate and control the microtubules and microfilaments inside the cell, which then determine the cell shape. But something else, too. Look at these microtubules here. They are connected to organelles. So they can actually move these organelles around inside the cell, and they can also move chromosomes around inside the cell during mitosis. So a microtubule you should actually think of as a little monorail inside the cell where organelles or other molecules can hop a ride and get to a different location within inside the cell. And there's a monorail that's really close to here. Where's a good place to go see a monorail and see how it works? Yeah, Disneyland has monorails, so you can hop a ride. And a monorail is just like a train, except it's got one track. Okay. All right, so here are the little monorails. That's how these vesicles move around. They can hop a ride onto different structures. Lysosomes, we talked about. Okay, so here is one right here, a lysosome. And in order for membranes to be stable, they need energy. All right, so for that lysosome to be nice and stable, guess what it needs? It needs ATP, right? And when a cell starts to run out of ATP, membranes get very leaky, all right? So including lysosomes. So if a lysosome gets really leaky because a cell is running out of ATP, is that a good thing or a bad thing? That's really a bad thing because now the lysozyme can start to digest all of the normal living molecules that are inside of the cell. And that hastens the death of that particular cell. All right, so when somebody is having a heart attack or when somebody is having a stroke, all right, when the oxygen is not getting to the tissues, right, it's important to give them membrane stabilizers to protect, in particular, what? The structure of those lysosomes. And a good pharmaceutical that's used to stabilize membranes is cortisone. All right, so now when somebody's having a heart attack or a stroke, they're administered cortisone, All right, and what does that do? That protects the membranes, the integrity of membranes, including lysosomes, and that just protects the living processes that are happening inside that cell. So it's important to know something about all of these organelles because it does have, what, very real and everyday importance to how we treat patients. So it's really important to know the functions of all these organelles inside the cell. And as a matter of fact, some cells don't live very long. They're programmed to die at a certain point in time, and it's the lysosomes then that help hasten that particular cell death, and then when the cell gets digested, that material can be used by other cells for their living processes. Okay, peroxisomes, we talked about mitochondria, we talked a little bit already about, namely, it makes oxygen, but I want you to know some internal structure of a mitochondria as well. Here is the outer membrane, here is the inner membrane. The folding of the inner membrane is what we call cristae. Right, so here is the intermembrane space, and then the space on the inside of the inner membrane is what we call the matrix. Right, but don't get confused with the matrix of a connective tissue. So all these folds right here are what we call cristae, and then here is the matrix. And we're going to spend a lot of time looking at mitochondria in terms of their biochemistry and on these different membranes right here. The interesting thing about mitochondria is that it contains a little piece of DNA. Mitochondria doesn't have its own nucleus, but it has its own DNA, and it's very, very small. And when you look at it underneath a microscope, it actually looks like a bacillus. It looks like a bacterium. And now it's generally accepted that a mitochondria, right, has a special association with human cells, and it has a nice symbiosis. And a good way to think of a mitochondria actually is as a bacterium. So when the cell divides via mitosis, right, that's controlled by the nucleus of the cell, but mitochondria within the cytoplasm control their own rate of replication. Right, so mitochondria are pretty much living their own lives within our cells, and we call that the endosymbiont theory. So millions of years ago, some cells that were very closely looking like human cells were infected by this bacterium, but they struck up a nice symbiotic relationship. Those cells didn't kill these mitochondria, and that's a really good thing, right? Because a symbiosis means that there are two organisms that come together and they both get something positive out of the relationship. So what is the positive thing that a human cell gets from a mitochondrion? It gets energy in the form of ATP, right? And that's really good to have, right? You couldn't even maintain consciousness without ATP. Now what does mitochondria get out of the deal by living within a human cell? What are some good things that mitochondria get out of the deal? They get protection, right? Because our human bodies have an immune system that fights other kinds of bacteria and viruses that might want to predate on the mitochondria. So they get protection. But what else do they get? That's not a small point. That's a very important point, protection. But they get oxygen, right? Because we're breathing all the time. They also get other nutrients like glucose to stay alive, right? So it's a very nice symbiotic kind of relationship. Okay, here's a ribosome. And what's a ribosome? It's important for protein synthesis. That's the workbench for proteins. And here you can see a little tunnel going through the ribosome. This is where the messenger RNA actually kind of runs right through the ribosome in order to make a protein. I think we talked about rough endoplasmic reticulum. We talked about the Golgi complex already. But remember that the Golgi complex or Golgi apparatus is part of this. It's just a step in this secretory pathway where proteins that are made by rough ER end up inside vesicles. And then these vesicles can stay within the cytosol or they can be used for exocytosis or secretion outside of the cell. Okay, we didn't talk about the nucleus. All right, so here is the nucleus. Inside the nucleus, you have chromosomes, and those chromosomes are used to make proteins. And those proteins can be used to regulate the function of the cell or to make structure of the cell. That information is very precious. If it gets damaged or destroyed, then the cell is going to die. So those chromosomes are protected behind this nuclear envelope right here. The active part of the nucleus is the nucleolus. That's the part that is actually making RNA and maybe even making some proteins inside the nucleus, but mostly it's making RNA. So just say that's the active part of the nucleus. Okay. The RNA that's made then leaves the nucleus through these little channels right here, which are pretty big, so we call them nuclear pores. All right, so guess what? Next time, we're going to start right here by looking at how we make proteins inside the body. All right, yeah, keep that sign-in sheet going around. Sorry I didn't pass it out a little earlier.